Okay, so last week we talked about the East European migration, and we focused on those people, the vast majority, that chose to settle in the cities. Today we're going to talk about a much less known story, and that is those people that settled in rural areas, like on the homesteaders. Think, little house on the prairie, except not, but we'll get to that. So, a little bit of background on the Jewish farm settlement. So, Jewish farm settlement is dated from 1880 to 1930, 1880 being the same year that the historians basically date the East European migration to the United States.
I'm sorry, what's the Jewish farm settlement? I need to
Oh,
know.
Jewish farm. Yeah, the movement of Jews being rural farmers.
Oh, it's a movement. What?
Yes and no. Well, you'll hear as I go forward that it's not like a loose movement. Like the people weren't necessarily connected, but there was kind of a movement to settle in rural areas, partially coming from them and partially coming from the Jewish community.
And they were from Europe?
Yeah, immigrants. Yeah.
This is coming to America,
Yeah.
and it was called the Jewish Farm Settlement.
No, I don't know that you would call it Jews on the homestead, the
So
rural settlement.
you're
I'm
just
saying
using, you're coining
I'm
the
calling
thing.
it the
Got
Jewish
it.
farm settlement.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not saying that was necessarily an original term, but I don't know if that's a universal term for this. About 8,000 Jews chose to settle in the homestead out of about 2 million total. So that's a very small minority. It was not a popular option, and most immigrants were probably not even aware that settling on the homestead was an option. So why go? Two main reasons. One is their socioeconomic standing. They either came to the United States poor or became poor, and city life was hard. City life conditions in the cities we talked about last week, the conditions were pretty gruesome. And if they didn't, few work opportunities, not that there were few work opportunities, but there were a lot of people for every opportunity in the cities. So if you don't like the living conditions and you don't have a good job situation, then the rural going and being a farmer was an option. There's also this symbolic construction of the rural landscape as promising like economic and social improvements. And this kind of romantic idea of we will own our own land and work the land and be, one with nature. That kind of romantic view. It's symbolic because if you think about Eastern Europe, there was a prohibition against land ownership. Jews couldn't own land for anti-Semitic reasons. So therefore, it was exciting to be able to own land. And if you know a little bit about the homestead in America, you filed a claim, and if you worked the land, then after a number of years, you cultivated it, the government approved, it became yours. You could own land in America. I mean, that was cool and exciting to be able to own land.
Can I ask a question about the owning land in Europe? So, in certain places, could you not own land? Because, like my own familial, like I had like two great grandfathers who owned the land. Like maybe it was earlier that they did
It
own the
was it would
land.
have depended on time.
Austro-Hungary,
Oh, that would be different than
Poland.
Poland, Russia. But you just didn't have it was very unusual to have a Jewish farmer. There were just were not many Jewish farmers.
But what they did, they were gentlemen farmers. They owned the land,
And other people were
and other people
cultivating. But
worked.
that it
So yeah, they
yes,
weren't
it would
Jewish
depend
farmers, but
on it would
they were
depend on
tenants.
time, but there were many places in Europe where that would not have been allowed. Farming was the non-Jewish profession. Their place in the economy was servicing the farmers. But they themselves would not have been like these large farmers.
So the fiddler on the roof cliche
The fiddler on the roof
is
cliche, Well, first of all, he wasn't a farmer. He was
old cows.
He was a milkman. He was a milkman in some.
Right.
So actually, if you watch Fiddler carefully, you'll see that it's the non-Jewish people. It's Fiedke who's always walking around holding a hoe. Like the Russian peasants are always walking around holding farming equipment, whereas there's the butcher, the tailor, the milkman. None of them are actually involved in the actual working the rural land. But that said, Fiddler on the Roof is so inaccurate that don't even get me started.
But you have land ownership and then you have farming,
right?
Which are two.
Yeah, that's not necessarily
right.
The same thing.
Was it different? I mean,
it would have been different.
Historically, you know, like I think the Austro-Hungarian Empire was friendlier.
They had Austro-Hungarian Empire are the ones who issued the Edict of Toleration, so they were much more westernized and enlightened than
Poland.
Where the Tsar, where Poland and Russia in this time period are relatively interchangeable because most of Poland has been taken over by Russia and is the Pale of Settlement within Russia. Russia was the least modern because the Tsars tried to keep out any modernizing influences. Okay, so you have this, okay, so the pro of this, you know, owning land and farming is exciting because that's something they could not do. The flip side of that is that they don't know the first thing about farming because they have no experience farming and no idea of what's involved. And if you read about the Zionist movement, that was the same thing with the ones from Russia who came to Israel to farm and work the land, and then they get their first set of blisters and are like, what did we get ourselves into? They don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the problems. Farming also offered independence and freedom. If you were a farmer, you were your own boss. And men in the homestead, in their diaries and memoirs, describe the farm using terms like freedom and opportunity. You could escape the factory bosses who are with their unfair policies and they're trying to cheat you and gyp you and change the clocks on you to make your day longer. Mm-hmm. Crowded apartments, urban anti-Semitism. You could control your own destiny. That was the romance of the homestead. The idea of Jews going out in the rural areas was backed ideologically and financially by some urban leaders and organizations and congregations. They believed it would solve two problems. Number one is it would solve the overcrowding in the ghettos and all of the disease. You know, rural life is better for your health than the unsanitary ghetto, better air. You know, that's where people with consumption went. They went to the rural area. You know, so it's better air, more healthy. And the other thing that it would do is get them out of the city where they're potentially an embarrassment to them. You know, if you have these new immigrants, you know, the greenhorns, and they're embarrassing with their old world ways, get them out. Get them out, and that way they're not there in front of you embarrassing you. And also the idea is that probably that will speed up Americanization. If they're tossed out into the rural landscape, but they're going to drop their old ways and adopt the American, become more American faster. It'll help in the process. They gave Jews startup money to help them in their ventures, farm equipment, supplies, and they continued to send money and kosher meat to certain settlements. But this kind of support usually only lasted about 2 or 3 years, and when support was withdrawn, the community usually withered. That was a theme throughout. So for the ones who were supported, usually when the support stopped and it didn't last that long, they could not make it on their own. The Kaloffs, Rachel Kaloff, her family, the family she marries into, arrived about 10 years after the first settlements in the region. Now, globally, this ends in 1930. We don't have a big Jewish farmers movement today. So why do they fail, okay? They eventually leave for external financial reasons and internal cultural reasons. The farm settlements in themselves fail because their lack of experience, because a poor choice of land, which again ties into not knowing exactly what to look for in choosing a piece of land, and low capital. They weren't coming in with startup capital if all their money is coming from charities, or they don't have any money, which it seems like in Rachel Kaloff's story does not seem like they were getting any charitable contributions, and it seems like they didn't have enough money for shoes. That's also going to be something that's going to lead to failure. People either failed or sold their farms and went into other businesses. For those people, farming was a step up the economic ladder, but people eventually went on to pursue other things. Once, after a couple of years, there was no longer the psychological state where there was a value in working the land or being one's own boss. They moved past that. They realized these goals, and the reality was their life was filled with physically challenging, repetitive tasks. And after a number of years of really of the physical hard work over and over again, so they're ready to, you know, move on into something a little more urban, white collar, even being a salesman or moving on to something else. Now,
did they come as a group or did they come singly? Because it sounds like the settlement.
They both. Both. Some Kaloffs came as a family unit. There was
a big family.
A big family. Uh-huh. So, you know, 1, 2, 3 main households and 2 little subsidiary households. So it's like 5 household family. Other people came as more of a group. Again, you know, they knew all the Jewish family. By the time Rachel is there, the Kaloffs already know every Jewish family in the region.
And what's the region? What's the region that we're talking about?
North Dakota. Which, in North Dakota, she does say what county it is. I don't remember the county off the top of my head. But she's in an area of North Dakota. That's where they settled. Oh, so.
That's funny. My husband's family is from there. He's from Winnipeg, but his...
Right, you told me. That's so interesting.
From Fargo. She lived in Fargo.
Was she...
I don't know.
See if you can find out if the family were homesteaders.
But it's interesting because, like, the non-Jewish homesteaders were very successful with their farming.
Some were and some weren't. Some were and some weren't. But part of what this book shatters is the kind of little house on the prairie myth of, mm-hmm. nice, happy, everyone's successful, everyone's clean in like pigtails and dresses and just presents the squalor. I mean, she moves into a shack. Mm-hmm. She gets married and moves into a shack, dirt floor, wooden walls. That's it, a shack. Wow. I mean, it's brutal. I'm even being a poor woman from Europe, she still was used to living in a building in a city. She was, you know, and she's, the day she gets there, she's crying her eyes out.
So like
what did I get myself into?
Bride, kind of?
She was a mail order bride. Mm-hmm. But wait, we'll get to her life in a minute. That is exactly what she was. Okay, so economically, that's one reason to either fail or move on. The other reason was culturally. Jews on the homestead were generally pretty lonely and poor. They lacked the communal nature that they were used to in Jewish communities. There's not enough people to have an organized shul community. They did not have regular rabbis. For spiritual needs, they had to import people. When Rachel Kaloff has a boy, they import a moel and have to pay for his train fare. When they wanted to slaughter one of their cows, they had to import a shochet. They didn't have any of these people around. Judaism also emphasizes education and emphasizes Jewish marriage. And the farms were too isolated from each other for either of these purposes. There weren't enough people to have a good Jewish education and enough Jews around to meet Jews and get married. So therefore, there was no continuity. Rachel, she's a mail order bride, but mail order bride from another country or even from a city is not going to work with the next generation because they're American, so they're not going to go for a mail order bride. So ultimately, the children leave for schools, they leave for work opportunities in the urban areas, they leave to get married. And when they end up leaving the farm, settling in the urban areas, and once the children left, their parents followed them. So that's another reason why people leave. Now, also what's interesting is that, you know, Jews value education. So they're sending their kids to college, but college is not the education. You don't go to college and be like, yeah, I want to go back and work the farms. So the next generation, they're going to be professionals. They're not farmers. You're in a culture that's valuing education, and meeting other Jews. Neither of those are consonant with the farm experience. So after a generation, that's pretty much it. It just doesn't continue to the next generation. There's no continuity. Judaism is hard to perpetuate in isolated areas. You need community, education, and marriage, and you don't have any of these in rural areas. And that, in a nutshell, is why this could never survive. So, and you'll see at the end of Rachel's story, they, at a certain point, they've just had enough. They had enough. They actually financially made it. I mean, they were financially secure to some extent, but they, at a certain point, just had enough, and they moved to St. Paul, and you get the impression that a lot of people also from their area ended up in St. Paul, which, in Minnesota.
It's also a rural area. Back then? I mean,
it would have been, like, there are many random Midwest communities.
I guess I'm thinking.
This year, when do they leave? They move back in. When did they move back?
She was born in Russia in 1876. Okay, so I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I'm thinking
you're thinking later?
I was thinking.
Oh, 1910.
This was happening.
No, 1917. 1917 is when they moved to St. Paul.
More like in the mid 1800s.
This is when you had a lot of Jews in a lot of metropolitan areas. This is kind of before, and there is still a Jewish community in St. Paul, and obviously a bigger one in Minneapolis, but there were just a lot of Jewish communities in a lot of cities that don't really exist anymore today, and they've kind of all consolidated themselves into bigger, and they all moved to bigger towns. Okay, so let's talk about Rachel Kaloff. So Rachel's in many ways the anti-Glickel. She, as nostalgic as Glickel is about her past, Rachel Kaloff is bitter. She's bitter and angry.
Well, if I was a male, were a mail order bride, I'd be bitter and angry too.
You know, it's interesting. That's the one thing she...
like, she was happy with.
Yeah, I'll tell. I don't want to answer that yet.
Okay.
I'm spoiling the ending. Okay. She's certainly not as religious as Glickel, though she does mention God at times. She mentions God, but God's not rolling off her tongue the way Glickel is. Psukim are not rolling off her tongue. She is not educated. She was literate, obviously, but you don't get the impression she had any Jewish education, any education at all. And she was poor. So she's born in Russia in 1876. Her mother dies at the age of 4. Her father leaves her and her siblings in the care of a Jewish servant girl that she was evil. Evil, took their food and gave it to her friends, beat them. It was horrible treatment. So they complain to her father about the horrible treatment. He dismisses a servant girl, thinks, he needs to remarry, and remarries an evil stepmother, who then is the same treatment. Which, I mean, you read, I gotta tell you, like, this is a great read. I mean, you sit down, you'll finish in one sitting, but it is so depressing. It is so heart-wrenching. Like, as much as Glickel's a fun read, this is just devastating on every level. Her childhood is miserable. And of course, you need to take the hatred with a grain of salt, because obviously she's bitter. You know, but servant's evil, stepmother's evil, father takes the side of the stepmother, so he's also, he's evil to them, treats them horribly, and then ends up, presumed dead in a shipwreck on his way to America when she was still a young kid. So they're then farmed out to their relatives, who are also treat them badly and are uncharitable. She's very negative towards her relatives. Basically, the kids are employed by relatives as servants. There's an impression her aunts and uncles wouldn't take her in just as their mother's child, but only as she applies for a job as a maid in her aunt's house to have some place to go and live. General bad treatment. She writes about her grandfather, who was what she calls a religious fanatic, and she hates him also. She hates him, and he was always critical of her, and I think just she to a great extent associates religion with him and with her mother-in-law, who she also thinks is a fanatic. So she does not have a positive outlook towards Frumkeit, towards being religious at all. I mean, you get the impression she is religious, but just kind of in a by default kind of way, and she doesn't really have a positive outlook. Okay. So while she's her aunt's servant and living in her wealthy aunt's house, she falls in love with the son of the local butcher, and he's in love with her. And he writes to her grandfather asking, he wants to, you know, permission to marry her. And the grandfather just is horrified because butcher is considered a low-class profession. And she was the descendant of, has some kind of yichus, and the grandfather has some kind of feeling about the prestige of the family, that it would be an absolute disgrace for her to marry the son of a butcher. And so he basically squashes this romance and separates them and doesn't allow them to get married. And you get the impression that she moves on from that in the book, but she is a little bit bitter about that. Yeah, she loved him. And I have to say, it's a really, it's a hard, as I'm reading it, on the one hand, you're like sympathetic. She could have married him. She would have been happy. He loved her. She didn't care to be married to a butcher. She's like, I'm poor. What do I care? But they were like, you know, and she's resentful about the family that they don't care enough about her to actually make her position in life higher or better, but they are still worried that she may be a disgrace to the family. So she's not, they don't like raise her to the status where she could have better marriage prospects, but they don't let her marry the person that she wants to marry. So on the one hand, I'm reading this and I'm sad for them. She could have married him, he could have married her, they loved each other, they would have been happy. On the other hand, knowing what's going to happen, the fact that she went to America probably saved her life. You know, in that, you know, had she married the butcher, she and her family could have been killed in the Holocaust. You don't know what would have happened there, that going to America might have been the best, you know, ultimately the best thing for her, even though, you know, you'll see that she has mixed feelings about the whole thing. So she is then an old maid at 18. She writes she's 18, and that's already the age where nobody knows what's going to be with her, and she has no marriage prospects. When the following situation arises, there's a man named Abraham Kaloff who lives in America, and he writes to his sister looking for a mail-order bride. His sister decides on a local girl whose name was Rachel. And everything was in order. She agreed, and they had done all the paperwork for her to immigrate. When the girl backs out, Rachel backed out. So Rachel Kaloff's uncle knows this woman and suggests, hey, I have an idea. I know a Rachel that you can substitute, right? So she's the right age, she's willing to go, and she has the right name. So she goes and meets the sister, and the sister does all these crazy inspection tests of her to see if she passes. She says she passes, and she writes to her brother, I found you a new bride. Now, what's the one step? They exchange pictures. That is the one. He gets to see her picture. She sees his picture. They liked each other's pictures. She agrees to go. There's a little bit of complication along the way because her last name does not match. Mm-hmm. But they somehow manage it. She gets to America. Last week I read a little bit of her trip over in steerage. She writes about basically vomiting for 20 days straight. It was a horrible, horrible trip, and just the nastiness of the conditions and the horrors of Ellis Island and all the inspections. And finally, she gets into the country. She spends one horrible day on the Lower East Side, where she's staying in an apartment with Abraham, which and I read this last week, where to talk about conditions there, that on one hand, she's horrified because she is staying in the same apartment as a man that she's not married to, and she has all these horror stories of white slavery going around in her head that she doesn't want to be tricked into prostitution. And there's also bed bugs and roaches running around the place, and she's just disgusted. And they have they go out on a date together, she and Abraham. He says to her that, you know, that he did pay her passage, but she doesn't owe him anything. And if she doesn't want to marry him, she doesn't have to marry him. And she decides that, you know what, he's a good guy, good character, we'll go through with it. And she leaves with him for North Dakota. Now, his family had already been in North Dakota, and he was now joining them there with her. She gets to North Dakota and is just horrified. And she's just horrified at the conditions. She's horrified at the physical conditions. She's also, and you see a little bit her own social snobbery here. She's horrified, let's see if I can find the page, at meeting them. When she meets them, she just, the way she describes these people. Here we go. As we climbed down from the wagon, I looked again at this assembled group and my heart sank still lower. The two brothers were so dirty and unkempt. They had wild, unshaven faces. Their skin was broken out in big pimples, and they wore rags wrapped around their feet in place of shoes. I learned that the women had no shoes at all, but were wearing the men's shoes this day in my honor. Even this dismal spectacle was inadequate to prepare me for the scene inside the miserable shack, which was this woman's home, this is her future mother-in-law. As we entered, my heart turned to ice at what greeted my eyes. This was my first sight of what awaited me as a pioneer woman. The furniture consisted of a bed, a rough table made of wood slats, and two benches. The place was divided up into two sections, the other being the kitchen, which held a stove, and beside it, a heap of dried cow dung. When I inquired about this, I was told that this was the only fuel this household had. They had no firewood at all. I silently vowed that my home would be heated by firewood and that no animal waste would litter my floor. How little I knew. She talks about the children. The little girl's feet were wrapped in rags. She had never owned a pair of shoes. And I love her description. Like one, she writes about the boy's running around with a shirt and no pants, and her elderly father-in-law's walking around with no drawers on. Like, she's like with drawers and no long pants. Like the kid, like everyone's missing. Everyone's basically walking around half dressed, right? The kids are half dressed. The worst of all is that the adults are half dressed. Okay. She immediately gets there and is immediately informed that Abraham, her fiancé, is being shipped off to work as a day laborer in someone else's farm to make money to support the whole family in the winter. And she is just hates the fact that basically the men, and also to some extent her mother-in-law, are making all the decisions, and she has no power. And she lashes out against this, and certainly is not the docile woman they were expecting to get. And she's like, well, why does he have to go? You know, starts speaking out. And it's interesting, she writes a number of times, she didn't get her way, but she feels like they respected her more for speaking up for herself, which I don't know if actually they did or they didn't, but certainly she felt like that gave her some sense of self. They get married. She describes their wedding. And then she's informed that in the coming winter, she'll be bunking with her in-laws because they don't have enough money to heat all the shacks. So she has to share a space with her in-laws, which she hates to no end. And she actually writes at one point about like privacy issues, which I think is a little bit of a... She writes about having conversations, but I also think privacy is a little bit of a euphemism of she's pregnant every year and how is that happening when she's sharing in these one-room shacks. And she writes that, like, she would go out into the prairie. That was the only place you could have privacy, was to just go out into the prairie. Or later on, when they have a barn, she said they had all their conversations in the barn so that the kids wouldn't hear things they were talking about. That, you know, and that's a really legitimate concern. You know, you want to have privacy, and, like, there's no privacy. Mm-hmm. Her family, her in-laws, they're constantly on top of her. Mm. The next couple of years, there's a cycle. They... One step forward, two steps back. They're doing well. Then there's a hailstorm that destroys their crop. And you feel like every time they've almost made it, something happens that just sets them back. And on top of that, she is in a constant state of pregnancy. Pregnant child. It's like every year. She has 9 children.
Whoa.
After the first...
She figured it out.
Yeah, I know. Right? After the first... she got lost in the prairie once, and she got lost in the prairie once, and, like, there's also the fear of getting, like, you know, eaten by, like, wild prairie animals. Yeah. Like, okay. So she has a cycle of growth, setbacks, and along this is her constant pregnancies, and she just every time about, like, every pregnancy is a story and some horrible thing happening. One time right after the baby's born, they don't realize the baby's hand was on the stove lid, which was hot and got badly. I'm telling you, stories are horrible. Her mother-in-law, when she has her first baby, her mother-in-law tells her to do some superstitious things to, like, ward off the demons. And she comes down with what is very obvious to the reader, postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. And she goes crazy thinking that there are demons attacking her babies and attacking her baby. And you see that, like, between postpartum depression and her mother-in-law, she's really being driven a little bit over the edge. Mm-hmm. One of the best stories in this book is that she has a baby boy. And they make a big party because it's really one of the first simchas that the family has really had. And so they shecht a cow. And the shochet says that the cow is treif. So they're devastated. But then Rachel wasn't doing so well health-wise. And the shochet says, you know what? You can eat. It's more important. You need to eat the meat to get healthy. So he gives her a heter to eat the meat. Mm-hmm. So she's like, okay. The mother-in-law is horrified. She thinks that the shochet is obviously some
heretic.
Heretic. Mm-hmm. And says to Rachel, if you eat that, I'll never eat in your house again. And Rachel's like, woohoo, 2 for the price of 1. Now, not only do I get to eat meat, but I get that woman out of my house every winter. And then once she's eating meat, the sons, which are not you see the religious divide. The brothers, Abraham Kael's brothers, are like, woohoo, you're eating the meat, we're eating the meat too. And they all basically took part in the treif cow, except for the mother-in-law, who, you know, wouldn't go near it. Another story is she decides to go to town for a birth because most of the babies were born in her house on the homestead, and when she started to feel like she's having too many complications. She hemorrhaged and almost died and lost a pregnancy. And so she decides to go to town. And the local doctor that attended her was drunk and almost killed her in childbirth. And she said that he was known to be drunk all the time and to have killed many a pioneer mother.
It's amazing that she survived all of that.
It's amazing.
And nine kids.
She said that she needed 9 live births and this one very late miscarriage. Like, she was close to delivering when she started hemorrhaging. Hmm. She said that she needed surgery later on in life to repair her insides. And even with surgery, she never was 100%. Eventually, by like 1910, you get the sense that they have made it in North Dakota. They are considered a prominent home, prominent, a Jewish center. On Jewish holidays, people from all over would gather at her house, and they would have, and she now had a large house built, and they would have a minyan there. They had plenty of food. The brothers had failed and moved, but they seemed to have made it. There were still setbacks, and in 1917, they felt like they're getting older, they have health issues, farming is too hard, and they moved to St. Paul. Abe builds and runs a grocery store, which failed, and then he became a dry goods salesman. So it doesn't seem like he really rose up in the social ladder by moving to the cities, but at least they were living in a sane place. Okay. Now, what is really just devastating for me as a reader, and I don't know if you feel the same, is you read this, and as much as the troubles that you see, they're facing so many troubles, they kind of like fight it together, and there's a lot of really nice moments. There's some fights also, but the story really is very nice moments about them as a couple, and you feel like they just really banded together and conquered the, you know, the wild kind of thing. So the memoir ends with them moving to the cities. The postscript, which is written by one of the children, says that after they moved to the city and the two of them were no longer fighting together to survive, they, quote, drifted apart. They found that they had separate interests, mm-hmm. and whereas it doesn't say that they ever separated or divorced, mm-hmm. he said, like, they always treated each other with respect, was the term they used. He writes that when they visited their children, they would come separately. Like they would visit separately. And it's such a hard thing to read after the whole memoir. Because yeah. she never actually writes negatively about being, you know, the mail order bride. It feels like it worked out nicely for her. She loved him. He loved her. They seem to have had a nice relationship. So it's kind of like, and then you're telling me, I mean, when I read in the postscript, I had to reread it like 3 times. Like, I must have just misread that. You did not just say that they were... They drifted apart. I mean, that's just devastating at that.
So sad.
It really is. I just felt like that, right. as sad and horrible as all the things are in the homestead, that to me was the most sad part of this. So what do we get from this memoir? So in terms of society, you see the religious tensions between the old generation and the young generation. She views her grandfather in Europe and her mother-in-law in America as religious fanatics. You see, she at her wedding, so Rachel has a very negative attitude towards the traditions and towards her mother-in-law, and the way that her mother-in-law was so controlling, like, no, you have to do this custom. She forced them to fast, and she forced Rachel to have her face covered by a flour sack during the wedding. And the thing is that she has issues with tradition, which are obviously like conflated with her mother-in-law. And part of the problem is that her mother-in-law, in many ways, if what she writes is accurate, is really wrong and extreme. She makes her be blindfolded the entire wedding. Mm-hmm. Not like the bedeckin and then 5 minutes later is taken off. She was blindfolded the entire dinner. Okay, so you kind of a little bit understand, and then, you know, with the demons, and you kind of understand why. It's like, you don't really like the mother-in-law, but you got to also remember daughters-in-law are not necessarily the best
historians,
right, are not necessarily the best historians when it comes to their mothers-in-law. Mm-hmm. But you just get the impression that this woman was just
psychotic or something.
Just crazy. I'm just a little bit nuts.
Well, she was living in a shack also.
Also true. But yeah, I mean, you get the impression that she was a little bit off the wall. Yeah. Or I don't know. Or controlling. Whatever it is. Wanted things done her way. But, I don't know where she got that from about the blindfolding. But, you know, I'm reading that and I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. And then, you know, you read critiques on this and they're like, yeah, we don't know where she got that from. You know, that it's a misinterpretation of law. And there's other places also where she does that. She says that after after Rachel has the baby, because she's a Nida, she has to be cold to her husband. You know, they're not allowed to sleep in the same shack. And, you know, she has a lot of things that are like, no, that's not quite right. But they're always like, the ones that Rachel mentions are ones that basically like put her in uncomfortable positions, you know, or were terrorizing to her. Okay, so you see that. You see the tension. And even with the sons, who are like, we're eating treif also. We're like, what do we care? You just get the impression the old generation are traditional and religious, and the younger generation are just not interested. They're not interested. They're doing other things.
Well, they're also in the shack in the middle of nowhere.
Right, true. But it was even in the urban areas also. I mean, you just, that whole generation, the next generation. But, yeah.
It's which is understandably so when you go out of extremes like that,
right?
That pushes people away.
Of
course.
Right, but in any case, it just wasn't. That's what was happening everywhere in America. You know, the next generation was just like that was very nice, and we're not interested. We're not interested.
Well, who doesn't want to fit in? I mean, that's
right. That's right. True. That's right.
And we have that.
That's right. Right, and that's something else you see is the social snobbery. You see in Europe about the inferior trades, like we can't associate with people like that there. And, you know, that was also very a source of tension in Europe and in America between religious and not religious, because the Talmud scholar, they were the people who were respected, and the butchers and tailors, they're not respected. And that was a source of hatred that once they came to America and kind of the tables were turned, you know, now we don't have to be. Now we're the important people because we're working and we make money, and you know, we don't have to have anything to do with
it. Even East European kind of mentality saw things like that?
Yeah, Yichus was in being a Torah scholar, and those were not respected professions. And you see, as much as she scoffs at her grandfather and social snobbery, you see it with her also about thinking, you know, the way she talks about when she arrives in North Dakota, can't believe like this was beneath a Jewish woman. How could you be walking around without like a proper dress? Not from a tznius perspective, that's beneath a Jewish woman. Right. So she very much has her social conceptions of what is appropriate for a Jewish woman and a Jewish man, and her husband's family do not meet those standards. And again, probably, you know, they probably weren't high class people in Russia either, where they came from. Okay, you see the differences in social mores. She comes to the country. She comes to the country. She's so worried about him taking liberties. And when he invites her to go out for a walk by himself, like to go out for a walk together, she's like very concerned. You know, should she do that? Should she not? And in the end, she goes with him. But it shows you that the different social mores between what would be appropriate courtship behavior in Europe versus America. America is way more liberal. I mean, it's way more open and way more liberal and way more, you know, anything goes. Like a man and a woman could go on a walk together in America. That would not have been acceptable in Europe. And we saw that also from Remembering. They were married. They couldn't even walk around together. That, you know, at different times. So that's something else you see, how different marriages there, courtship in America and then in Europe. And eventually courtship is going to be something that undoes the Jewish rural movement, because they need to get married. They need to get married. Family. It's interesting. Both Rachel and Glickel seem to be perpetually pregnant the entire book. Their attitudes are so different. Glickel, if you remember, had like a very positive attitude towards pregnancy. She refers to it as her perpetual load. She's not having another child again, and then finds herself pregnant again. She's a much more negative view towards pregnancy. And, you know, it probably has a lot to do with the world she was bringing him into. You know, Glickel was wealthy. Yeah. Glickel was wealthy. Mm-hmm. You know, she probably was concerned about dying in childbirth, but Rachel's like confident every childbirth that she's not pulling through this one. And, and you know, in a little bit, to some extent, you can't blame her. Mm-hmm. Every childbirth is in one way or another traumatic. And, you know, as much as Glickle, while living 200 to 300 years earlier, had whatever medical care money could buy, whereas she was just as much on her own, and in a sense less, because she had nobody to help her deliver. So the mother-in-law helps her deliver, sends her off the deep end, and then she says that, like, her mother-in-law is not, then, like, the next delivery, she's, like, calling her mother-in-law to come back and be there for her. And I'm reading this thinking, like, why do you want her back? But then it's like, think about it. There's no one else. There's nobody else. Even the mother was in Devil's Lake, which was the closest town, and there was a blizzard, and she goes into labor, and she sends her brother-in-law in a blizzard to go retrieve the mother-in-law. And it's like, she first said, nope, the mother-in-law's not going to be there, and then changed her mind, no, she needs the mother-in-law. Why? I don't know. You know?
She was alone.
Right. She was alone. She said there was one niece, there was a niece that she said saved her life, because it was the niece that talked her back from the edge after the postpartum depression. Mm. And later on, her daughters help her, because her... Mm-hmm. Her daughter's already 13, they can... Mm-hmm. You know, her oldest two are daughters. There was nobody else. Why have the mother-in-law back? There's no one else. You see the gender tensions within the family of who's making the decisions, and her very much feeling that she wanted to be making her decisions. So it's interesting. Like, you kind of see here the move to the nuclear family, because the mother-in-law's kind of perception is the family unit, whereas her perception is... I want me and Abraham, our family, and we should be making the decisions for our family, which is also something that will become very American, especially post-World War II with suburbanization and with all these single-family homes popping up, that you're not going to live, urban or rural, you're not going to live on the same block. You're not going to live within 50 feet of your extended family anymore. You're going to be, you know, a nuclear, which was the reality, You shared an apartment, you shared a home, you shared a homestead, you all lived on the same block within the same two block radius, and that's not going to be the reality anymore in America. People are going to move apart, and the focus will be on the nuclear family, you really see the movement towards that, where she, you know, had enough of them and wants to have her own. She wants to have her own family, make her own decisions.
And she gets rid of him.
And then in the end, I'm telling you, I find that so upsetting. Life on the homestead. There's one thing I want to read you about her. She says she gains status in the household because she figures out a way. They were all going to sleep at sundown, because they had no way to continue light. So she decides she's had enough, and she figures out a way using mud, and she creates a mud cup, smears it with butter, and takes a piece of rag as a wick, and basically creates little lamps that way. So everybody was, like, very impressed with her. And there's a few times where she really writes about her resourcefulness. This is kind of my favorite. I think this is the nicest part of the whole book. I just want to find it. She goes around, promptly my exploration brought results. I found what appeared to be wild garlic. I was delighted and ate a kernel. It tasted wonderful, and it didn't seem to harm me, so I gathered quite a number of bunches. My ambition was now on the rise. I enlarged my search area, and before long I came across plants, which unquestionably were wild mushrooms. Now, I knew some mushrooms were deadly poisonous, but still I thought it was a good time to take a chance. So I bit into one, and I held it in my mouth, and it didn't burn or taste bad, so I swallowed it. I waited a while for something to happen. Nothing did, and I gathered an apron full of mushrooms, and with my garlic and bundle of dry grass on my shoulder, I started for home, happy with my accomplishments and eager to see how I could put them to use. So she fries everything. She fries everything, all the stuff together, and creates this fine dinner. I'd used my brains and my nerve, and as a result, my husband would soon sit down to a fine dinner, just the two of us alone. Soon Abe arrived. It was evident that we liked one another, because when he came inside where I was, it was easy to see he was glad to see me, and we were happy to be together. Never was there a more delightful dinner than that one. The food was delectable, and our shanty was filled with happiness. After we finished our meal, Abe insisted on knowing all the details of my accomplishments. As he listened, his gladness became tinged with a sadness that our condition was such that I was reduced to searching the prairie for food. But nothing could destroy the magic of that hour. He kissed me and called me his good angel, and my contentment was complete, knowing that he appreciated my devotion to him. I served the barley coffee in the cool outdoors, and we spent another pleasant hour together before Abe returned to the field. So ended a charming interlude in the harshness of our lives. It was a great moment for us, and its memory has been a sustaining treasure to me over the years. Wow. It was really nice. And also she writes about how she whitewashed her. She figured out ways to paint her shack, and soon she has the nicest shack of the family. Yeah. Right, the nicest shack of that all. So that is Rachel Califf's story, which I prefer to leave off the epilogue because I like to kind of end it there, where it's nice. But so, as she in a sense makes the best of her situation as best she can, and so this memoir kind of is definitely not happy like Glickle, but you know, has its moments. So that's the life of the homestead. You are welcome.
With her children was good.
Yes. Yeah, okay. She is. Yeah, she has a good relationship with her children. Mm-hmm. They, you know, become middle class Jews all over the country. And a granddaughter finds the memoir. They basically knew it existed, but then got it published. It was not meant to be published. She wrote it. She didn't write it to be published. She wrote it for her family. But what's interesting about this is that she doesn't write it to her children the way Glickle does. Mm-hmm. And to this day nobody knows why she wrote it.
Well, she had nothing else to do.
Right, I guess so. But when she was older, she wrote it much later. Anyway,
she had paper. And
no, she wrote it in the city.
Oh.
She wrote it in 1930. Okay. She wrote
it
well.
It was memories.
This was written in 1936. So she wrote it after 20 years after she left the homestead. It just seems like one day she just bought a notebook and wrote it, and no one knows why. Yeah, I don't know why she did.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thank you. This was a really fun semester. So thank you all for coming and learning with me. Thank you to you watching at home for coming and learning. This was a really fun class.